This is Smeagol. When I'm not trying to protect my precious from wicked, tricksy hobbitses, I'm listening to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. They talk about many things that you filthy fanboys will love to listen to. And while you're listening, make sure you follow them on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and any social media on which you can find them. What is Twitter? Is it a bird? Is it tasty? Can I eat it? I can't eat Twitter. Smeagol is so sad. Smeagol wants to eat Twitter. Well, if I can't eat Twitter, I'll go listen to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. It will make Smeagol happy again. Happy, happy, happy! Just make sure you don't touch my precious while I'm listening.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm here to be part. I'm here to be part-time. I'm here to be part. I'm here to be part-time. Part-timefanboy.com.
Well, I should say, first of all, thank you for coming on to the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. This is the 300th episode, or once we complete it, which is why I very much wanted to have you on, because I love your books, or
thank
I love
so much.
The books that you work on. So I was like, I'm reserving episode 300 for this chap, for this gentleman. For those listening, my name is Christian Horn. This is the 300th episode of Part-Time Fanboy, and I am talking to Keith Dallas, who is, should I say, the mastermind behind American Comic Book Chronicles, or how should I address you, sir?
Boy, ringleader, I guess, yeah, let's go with ringleader.
Okay. Sounds good to me. I'm very happy to have you on. I was attempting to have you on earlier in like November, but you know, defecation occurs, as I often say. And so we had to push back a little bit, and we are now chatting in December. So in any case, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Originally we were going to be just chatting about the 1940s edition, but, right. The author of that volume was not able to join us. And, so we're here and we're going to chat about the whole series, correct?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. Sounds awesome.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that Kurt couldn't join us, but I hope, you know, I hope you can have him on, your show at some future day. He's a great guy. He's really, you know, the work he did on the first 1940s volume is just unprecedented,
yeah.
I'll say.
Yeah, and, well, we should say that his full name is Kurt Mitchell, and he is the author of the 1940s volume, which came out, what, in the fall, correct?
That came out, geez, when did it come out? That came out...
Recently, correct?
Yeah, I want to say August?
Oh, August, that far back. Yeah, and there was some, like, originally I wanted to interview you guys back then, and there was some, like, missed email communication or whatever, but we're here now. So, the American Comic Book Chronicles, you and I chatted a little bit before, because, like I said, we did sort of set up an interview, and there were some technical difficulties, and we couldn't complete it, but we chatted a little bit about... back and forth, sort of like the generalities of it. But for people who do not know what the American Comic Book Chronicles are, why don't you tell them? Because I explain them as sort of like an encyclopedic you know, volume, but you kind of were like, no, no, no.
Yeah, no. I sort of object to that. You know, any word associated with encyclopedia.
Sure,
I mean, I understand why people use it, because it does try, when you say encyclopedic, it sort of implies, you know, all-encompassing and, you know, wide-ranging. So I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But American Comic Book Chronicles is a series of volumes narrating comic book history, American comic book history.
Sure.
From the, I mean, we're planning to have a 1930s volume, or even it's going to call it a 1930s volume, but it's really everything before before 1940. So it's even going to cover, you know, comic books that predate the 1930s. But we'll say, you know, from the 1930s through the 1990s, and my publisher has even mentioned, in interviews,
in an interview with me,
right?
Yeah,
that he wants to do, and even, you know, volumes dedicated to the 21st century.
That's great.
Which was news to me when he told you.
Yeah.
But so for people who are unfamiliar with the project, it's, you know, again, each volume is dedicated to a specific decade. The 1960s and the 1940s, we have two volumes, you know, for those decades. But what each volume does is it goes year by year through the decade, narrating what's going on in the comic book industry. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll pick the 1980s as an example. Starts off in 1980. Each chapter has a timeline that contextualizes comic book history with, you know, pop culture events, with historical events. So you get an idea of what's going on elsewhere, what's going on in America, in the world, as these comic books are being published. And each volume is trying to not just explain what's being published, but also, you know, put spotlights on specific creators, you know, on the creators that are making an impact on the industry. It's trying to explain the trends that are going on in the industry. Mm-hmm. Explain, you know, the concerns of the industry, whether it's censorship, whether it's you know, comic book gluts or implosions or things like that. You know.
Yeah.
And so, and that's why, you know, when you say encyclopedia, you say, okay, I want to learn about Abraham Lincoln. Okay, so you go to the L, you go to the volume that's devoted to the letter L, uh-huh. And then you flip through it, and you find Abraham Lincoln, and there's an entry on Abraham Lincoln.
Sure.
And that's why I object to encyclopedia or encyclopedic, because that's not really what this is meant to be, is a running narrative of the comic book industry. So let's say you wanted to read, you know, it's meant to be like a history novel.
Sure.
You know, where, you know, obviously, instead of dealing with historical figures, well, I guess you're dealing with comic book historical figures, and
sure,
as well as, you know, publishers and publications and things like that. So each volume is roughly 300 pages, and as such, that means there's going to be topics that we can't cover. You can't cover an entire decade in 300 pages and be comprehensive, you know.
Yeah.
So the way I like to describe it is we try to provide as much of the landscape of the comic book industry as possible.
Yeah.
So inevitably, there are creators, there are publications that don't get the spotlight maybe they deserve. But then that's why I point people to, like, Back Issue Magazine.
Yeah.
Or Roy Thomas's Alter Ego, because then, you know, those magazines publish articles that provide more detail on specific comic books, on specific comic book creators. So it's almost, you know, they're almost complementary texts, you know.
Yeah.
American Comic Book Chronicles and Back Issue Magazine and Alter Ego Magazine.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And we should say, I mean, when I first interviewed John Morrow, who is the publisher of Two Morrows Publishing, that's where you can find these books, at twomorrows.com.
Right.
That's the publishing company that puts out these books. And when I interviewed him for his book Stuff Said, which is an excellent book,
yes,
we did talk about some of the other stuff that he published, which, you know, it landed on these books. And I think I literally said to him, like, whoever's doing those books is doing God's work, because I mean, these things are like great. I mean, for particularly anybody who's very interested in sort of like the history of comic books and sort of like going through the years and like you said, getting sort of some of the milestones, but you also dig a little bit into other things that, you know, I didn't know about or had never sort of been exposed to. And for someone like me who loves comics, loves the history of comics. And, I think I first started reading about comics, like when Chip Kidd sort of started coming out with like his books on like Superman and like Wonder Woman and I'd always read about comics, like, you know, in high school and stuff like that. But those were sort of like the more comprehensive, like I put these up with those, where this is a much more like look, like you said, at the history of everything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I can't stress enough that even though I'm listed as the editor in chief, again, / ringleader. this is not a one man show. I mean, this is, you know, we have a stable of writers. You know, Kurt Mitchell, you know, as we mentioned before, doing the 1940s. The late Bill Shelley did the 1950s volume. John Wells did the 1960s volume. Jason Sachs and I did the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s volume. Mm-hmm. So we have, you know, not only a stable of writers, but as well, you know, people that we contact, you know, for fact checking, for proofreading, for help. You know, people like John Cook or John Jackson Miller, who, you know, John Jackson Miller is sort of the expert on comic book circulation. And I want to stress that if you go to the back of these volumes, you will see how many sources we reference. I mean, we're referencing other history books. We're referencing articles. We're referencing interviews that we found on websites. So it's trying to collate as much research as possible. And that's what I mean by it's not a one-man show. It's not even just us. It's not even just me and my writers. It's also me, my writers, and the historians who sort of paved the way to who were, you know, writing articles and books about comic book history, mm-hmm. you know, decades ago. And, you know, we reference them. And it's it's a project as much as possible meant to, you know, encompass the legacy of comic book history, if I'm making sense.
Oh no, you totally make sense. I mean, for me, I remember when I found out about these books and I came across them in a comic shop, because these have been printed, like, I don't know when the first one came out, but I want to say like within the last 10 years or so, right?
Oh yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Or even longer than that. And like volumes would come out kind of sporadically, or, you know, here and there. And I don't know which, I can't remember which the
very first volume was John Wells's 1960 to 1964.
Oh, okay.
And that was published in 2012.
Yeah. Oh wow. Okay. So yeah, I definitely picked that up in like a comic shop, and my local comic shop, and opened it up and looked at it. And I was like, oh, this is something that I have to have, like, right away. I was like, I definitely know more than sort of like the average person about comics, but I am not like super, you know, I'm not like Mark Waid or anything. I don't know like right. when red kryptonite first showed up or gold. You know what I'm saying? But I do love like delving into the history of it. And, you know, you say that, you know, you don't dive into everything, but it's pretty comprehensive. I mean, I've been very impressed by the stuff that I've learned or read about, or even the stuff that I knew about. And I'm like, damn, this is in this book. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. We try to be as comprehensive as possible. I mean, you know, we've had some readers and say like some creators who, you know, have grumbled a little bit about, okay, well, you know, I don't understand why you didn't include this or you didn't include that. And, sure. and I acknowledge that, you know, I say, you know, you're right. I wish we had more pages. Say, you know, I know one person said, well, why didn't you divide the 80s into two volumes? And sure. I said, hey, I would have loved that because that's the decade I grew up, you know, basically reading. I would have loved that. But John Morrow has a great sense of what the bookstore market can, you know, what we can sell to the direct market and to the bookstore market. And it's a risk. Uh-huh. It's, you know, it's to divide each decade into two volumes. That's a big risk. I mean, mm-hmm. as you know, these are not cheap books to buy.
Yeah.
I know a lot of retailers who are reluctant to carry it because unless someone pre-orders it, because you're talking about a $50 book that you're keeping on your shelf and mm-hmm. And you're hoping somebody passes by it and go, oh, that looks, you know, I mean, and I have to credit, you know, our designers, you know, Bill Walco and David Paul Greenewalt, who, you know, as you know, it just flip through the book.
Yeah.
And you don't even have to read. You just look at the way these books are designed. I mean, they're really visually stimulating and fascinating in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I love the covers because that's the thing that sticks out the most because it's a really smart design, in my opinion, as someone who's like been involved in graphics and stuff like that. It sticks out in a comic book store because like there's a lot of white. Like sort of on the left, and then you've got like a panel of like different comic book cover books. But as far as like sort of the plethora of things that you're going to encounter in a comic shop, you know, when you see a white cover like that with whatever color lettering, like the particular volume I have in my hands right now is the 1990s, and it's blue lettering. But in any case, you know, you're going to see that white, and it definitely grabs your eye. It sticks out against the shelf. So kudos to them for the design of the cover because it also does give it, I know you don't like the term encyclopedic, so I'll say scholarly. It makes it looks like a smart book. You know what I'm saying?
I gotcha. Yep.
It looks like someone smart would be reading, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And, you know, even though these books are expensive, I mean, we hope that it's, you know, worth people's money. You know, we try to make it, you know, as, you know, as packed with information as also, again, as pleasurable to read. And that's, you know, when that's my charge to the writers.
Mm-hmm.
I said, look, you're not writing a Wikipedia entry.
Sure.
This is not, you are writing a narrative. You know, so, and not just a narrative, but a historical narrative. So it's got to be accurate and it's got to be entertaining.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, that's the challenge, is both collecting the facts and then presenting it in a way that is going to keep people reading. And if, you know, now I'm looking at the original, so the first 1960s volume has been reprinted,
mm-hmm.
but in the original, in the first printing, in the back, they have, you know, we included the original publication schedule.
Yeah,
and I have to chuckle at it because we clearly were naive.
Yeah, at... I remember that they were supposed to come out more regularly, right? Correct?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah. Uh-huh. And yeah, we didn't even come close. I mean, everything, I mean, I'm looking at it now and I can't help but laugh, is everything was supposed to be published by the end of 2014, uh-huh. With the exception of the 1990s, not the 1990s volume, but uh-huh. from the 1940s through the 1980s was uh-huh. all supposed to be published by the end of 2014. And we
genius
weren't even.
Takes time.
Yeah, we did. Well, it's, well, I don't know about genius, but I joke with John that these books are going to be the death of me.
Well, I mean, how, so, I mean, that kind of leads me to another sort of like line of inquiry. Like, how did you become involved with them? I mean, how does someone sort of, I mean, I'm obviously you're a fan of comics, correct?
Right.
But
yep.
how do you, were you involved in Tomorrow's back then? I mean, publishing?
Yeah. So you know, I'll try to be quick with this story is that.
Oh, you can take your time. We're on a podcast. So,
oh, yeah.
You know.
Are we taking callers as well or no?
No.
I know. I'm joking.
That's too fancy for this podcast.
So Tomorrow's back, geez, I'm trying to remember the first one that they published. I want to say this was like in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
They started a companion line, okay. which were books devoted to specific DC Comics properties.
Mm-hmm.
So Roy Thomas, you know, was putting together these All-Star companions devoted, obviously, to All-Star Comics, you know, to the Justice Society.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There was also a Teen Titans companion, or just the Titans companion.
And yeah,
there
was a, I can remember
there was a Legion companion. Now that's how I discovered Tomorrow's, is that
okay.
I, you know, similar to how you found American Comic Book Chronicles in the bookstore, Legion of Superheroes is my second favorite DC property. And
okay. What's your favorite?
Well, I'll get to that.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I see this book called The Legion Companion, and it's a book it's just chock full of interviews of Legion of Superhero creators, you know, Paul Levitz, Keith Giffen, Mike Grell, Dave Cockrum,
mm-hmm.
you know, Kurt Swan, you mean just, you know, Jim Shooter, just writers and artists who have worked on the Legion, you know, throughout the years. And I bought it without any hesitation and like read it within a week and I loved it. And I said, I have to write the companion book about my favorite DC Comics property, which is The Flash.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So that was in 2004. Now, in 2004, I really didn't have the resume. If I had contacted John Marr in 2004, he would have just said, "Who are you?" You know, I was writing reviews for a comic book website. I was doing interviews. And so I really, you know, I hadn't really anything published. So I said, okay,
what website was that?
It was originally silverbulletcomics.com.
Okay. Yeah.
And then that became Comics Bulletin.
Okay.
So, in short order, I had become the editor-in-chief of Comics Bulletin, and I had conducted a lot of interviews as well as, written reviews and articles. So finally in 2006, I'm crossing my fingers that no one has tapped John to do a Flash companion, but I said, okay, you know what? I've now written enough articles and reviews and conducted enough interviews that I feel a little more comfortable pitching John.
Mm-hmm.
And I had spent 2 years just putting together an outline, you know, putting together essentially a table of contents. So like,
sure.
this is who we would, this, you know, these are what the sections would be.
Mm-hmm.
So when I contacted John, I had done my homework. I had sort of tried to prove to him, like, this is something that I had been thinking about for a while. This is something that, is going to be relatively easy for me to put together because
sure.
I've already got the plan.
Sure.
So, and he still, you know, he still asked me, he's like, you know, I mean, he didn't say, who are you? But he, you know, he said, well, you know, have you published anything? Have you written anything? And I said, honestly, this would be my first book. And I understand if that's giving you pause, but I sent him just, you know, dozens of links of things that I had written.
Sure.
And I guess that impressed him enough where he just said, okay, you know what? Yeah, go ahead and tackle it. Now, I was in a queue of companion books to be published. So there was a Batcave companion. There was a Krypton companion. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones that came out. You know, so it was doing well for Tomorrows. I mean, as you can imagine, you know, it's a DC focused series of books. You can only publish those books though through a licensing arrangement with DC Comics.
I see. Yeah.
So that was 2006. That was the end of 2006. By like January of 2007, I had finished the manuscript, and John, I emailed John. I said, okay, we're already designing the book. Bill Walco and I, Bill who had done the Titans Companion. I said, you know, we're pretty much done. And he was impressed, and he said, okay, I'm going to move you up in the queue.
And
thank God that happened, because shortly after my book was put on schedule and the print run was ordered, DC Comics essentially quadrupled its licensing fee. I don't think John wants me to mention specific numbers, but
sure,
the original agreement was manageable. It was, you know, DC was getting a certain amount of money, these books could still be profitable for John Morrow.
Sure.
So, but I guess, I don't know, I guess they looked at how many companion books were being published, and they just said, okay, you know what? DC Comics said, okay, you know, there's got to be something going on here where they're making more money than we think they are, so let's go ahead and quadruple.
Oh my God,
it became, if we had published these books,
yeah,
we're essentially giving all the money to DC Comics. There would have been minuscule profit for John Morrow. So he had to pull the plug on the line.
And
no joke, Christian, that it was almost immediately after the Flash Companion had come out. So I think the final volumes in that line were, there was the Flash Companion, I think the Hawkman Companion, and maybe one of Roy Thomas's, I think Roy Thomas's, the fourth volume of Roy Thomas's All-Star Companion, and then that's it. And then he had to pull the plug.
Oh, wow.
But if I had not been diligent, the Flash Companion would never have, you know, come out in the first place.
Sure.
So when it came out, it sold really, really well. It sold, you know, better than John had hoped. So he asked me, he said, hey, you know, give me another idea. You know, what other books do you want to, do you want to write? And he said, look, just so you know, it cannot be a DC centric book. Because, you know, we're no longer going to have the license. And he said, before you ask, don't even attempt to do a Marvel Comics focused book, because their licensing fee is even worse. Even more exorbitant.
So
I'm racking my brains. I said, okay, you know, and as the saying goes, you know, write what you know. Again, I grew up in the 1980s. I feel I'm very familiar with the 1980s comic book industry. So after some thought, I said to John, I said, okay, so you we're trying to do a book that's fair use, you know, that's, for people who are listening and don't understand the concept of fair use, meaning, you know, that something that is scholarly enough or historical enough that no publisher can say, well, you know, you're, even though you're referencing our characters, it can be confused for one of our publications, which is what the companion line essentially is. When you see a book that's devoted to the Flash, the natural assumption is that it's being published by DC Comics.
Sure.
So that's why, you know, you can't just, you know, you and I can't just suddenly publish a book about Superman.
Sure.
Because DC would just bring the hammer down on us and say, no, listen, that we own that character. And even though it's, you know, you're trying to do some scholarly book about Superman, there's going to be the assumption it's published by DC Comics, and listen, their lawyers are going to be better than whatever lawyers that we
yeah.
hire. So,
uh-huh.
So I said, okay. So I said, I think I got an idea here that will work. You're trying to find a topic that's encompassing enough so that no publisher can say, no, that's going to be confused for a Marvel Comics book or for a DC Comics book or for an image, you know. So I said, I want to do a book about the 1980s, year by year. We'll start, you know, we'll go chronologically through the decade, and we'll cover all the publishers, not just Marvel, not just DC, but all those, you know, wonderful direct market publishers that arose during that decade. Eclipse Comics, Pacific Comics, Kamiko, Dark Horse.
Yeah.
First Comics. And because the book is encompassing the entirety of the comic book industry, it falls under fair use. So we don't have to worry about DC or Marvel coming after us and saying, you know, you can't do this book.
Mm-hmm.
So John's like, I love that idea. I think, I think part of why he loved it is because it's, you know, he doesn't have to worry about paying a licensing fee.
Sure.
And he said, but I don't want to do just a book about the 1980s. I want to do the gamut of comic book history.
Oh, boy.
And I said, well, you know what? I said, I really feel I'm most suited for writing about the 1980s, but let's do this. Why don't we put together a team of writers, you know, who can tackle each decade? And, you know, I'll be the editor. I'll oversee it to make sure that the volumes are all, you know, have the same, you know, style. They're all, you know, the same format. And he's like, okay, let's go. We'll do it. And that's sort of the secret origin of American Comic Book Chronicles.
Well, it's amazing to me because what I'm thinking right now is like, you know, you were talking about your resume and, you know, that you didn't want to pitch it, the Flash companion right away and all this stuff. And you had done one book for him and for him to go, hey, let's do the whole history of comics.
Right.
Like, didn't that didn't give you sort of like, oh my God, like I'd probably go into like a fit, like, you know, go into the vapors or something, like start, you know, hyperventilating or something. If somebody was like, did you, or were you just so excited about the idea that you were like, this is awesome? And
yeah,
I
was naive at the amount of work that needed to be done. I was completely naive. I quickly found out, you know, the amount and again, Christian, it's twofold. It's the amount of research. Cause first there's just obviously the primary sources, right? You're reading the actual comic books, but also you're trying to read as many interviews, as many articles, as many, you know, fanzines that are covering the industry. So it's a ton of reading. It's just a ton of reading. And then beyond that, it's now like, okay, so now you've collected all this information. How do I present it in a way that people are going to find entertaining, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't realize the task at hand until I actually started doing it. And then that's, again, that's why I look at this original publication schedule. And it wasn't just me. I mean, every single person that agreed. I mean, I wish Kurt was here because he could tell you himself.
Sure.
You know, especially for the 1940s, it's like, oh my God, you mean that's, you know, trying to research that is a gargantuan task. So, but every single author would, you know, even if I tried to tell them, like, just so you know, it's a ton of work. And then they like, yeah, but it's, you know, we're writing about comic books. I'm like, okay. And sure enough, a few months down the road and they're like, oh my God. I'm like, yeah exactly.
That's me sometimes with this podcast where I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? Yeah. No, but not nearly as much work as what you've done there.
And to John's credit, you know, I mean, it's, I mean, obviously, you know, John will like announce that he'll announce like a book. Thankfully, he won't put it on the publication schedule. I mean, it, then it's not like he puts it on the release schedule.
Sure.
But he'll announce a book and then he'll ask, you know, he'll contact me like every few months or so and ask about progress. Mm-hmm. And I'll be completely honest with him about where we stand. And I could tell, you know, he's obviously, you know, disappointed if we're behind schedule. But I keep trying to stress to him, like, look, we are trying to make this the best product possible. And it's, you know, it's just involving a little more research or a little more fine tuning, or let's say I'll get a chapter from an author and it's just not reading well. It's reading like a Wikipedia entry. It's not reading like a narrative. And I'm like, we got to rewrite this too. And that's time consuming. That's time consuming. And thankfully, John's very understanding about that. You know, it's just because, and also just making sure the facts are right. I mean, the facts have to be right. We can't, you know, which is not to say that we've been perfect. I mean, we've, you know, creators and readers have pointed out like, no, you know what, I don't think you meant this date. You meant this date, you know, so maybe we get a date wrong, or maybe we get the name of a creator wrong. You know, thankfully I really can't think of any like enormous blunder. You know, it's not like we said like Clark Kent is really Batman or anything like that.
So, yeah, that would be bad.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. How do you go about like cherry picking like what goes in? Because I mean, when we had our conversation last time, we kind of got into a little bit of a conversation about the 90s, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And sort of the bad rap that it gets, you know what I mean?
Yes.
And I think that rap is legitimate when it comes to the big two. But as you have said, you know, there's a bunch of books that I actually discovered in the 90s that saved me from dropping out of comic books, like Milk and Cheese or Tank Girl or Hellboy, stuff like that.
Right.
So, but how do you, because there's, like you said, I mean, you just went through the 80s and you were talking about Comico and, you know, all these other publishers that probably people listening to this podcast have never heard of, you know. But how do you go about saying, like, this goes in, this doesn't go in. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, without it just being completely arbitrary, without it just being like, okay, well, these are the books that I was interested in. So well, one is, you know, consulting the quote unquote bestseller charts. You know, it's like, okay, well, what was selling? You know, what was popular?
Sure.
Which that is relatively easy to figure out. Again, John Jackson Miller is someone that I, you know, consult with frequently, and he does a great job of tracking that historically. So you can look, you can access his research and say, oh, okay, so, wow, what a surprise! X-Men was selling well in the 1990s. Okay, so you know, you do feel. I mean. Imagine a 1990s volume that didn't include X-Men, you know?
Sure.
And so you feel obligated
ridiculous.
To, yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you feel obligated to deal with the bestsellers, but you also, and this is where the secondary research becomes really valuable. What were people talking about, you know? And so this is where accessing magazines like Wizard or Comics Buyer's Guide or, a comic reader for, you know, going back further into
comic
like
comic reader.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And say, okay, well, what were they talking about? Like, what were people writing in about? Mm-hmm. And some of the things that people were writing in about weren't bestsellers, but, you know, it deserves mentioning because it's something that the readership or the fan base was particularly interested in, you know, and also, you're just you're looking at, say, awards lists, things like that, that say, okay, books that are getting acknowledged as, you know, exceptional,
and maybe
they're not even selling well, but because they're winning an award or being nominated for an award, you know, so that plays into the selection. But also, sometimes you find an interesting story, you know, So, for instance, in the 1980s, are you familiar with the Thunder Agents?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So Wallywood treated the Thunder Agents back in the 60s.
Sure.
And he passes away in the early 1980s. And there becomes essentially a legal tug of war over who owns the Thunder Agents.
Okay.
John Carbonaro believed that he had purchased the rights to the characters from Wallywood himself.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a man named David Singer who argued, no, the Thunder Agents are in public domain.
Oh, okay.
So anybody and everybody is allowed to publish their own Thunder Agents comic book. So he went ahead and started – And he put together, an A team of creators. He had George Perez.
I kind of remember this.
He had George Perez doing covers.
He had
writers like
Steve. That's how I discovered them.
Those are some pretty high profile books. They were a little more expensive, but they were thicker books, and they were well put together. But eventually, he lost the battle to keep publishing his stories because John Carbonaro sort of prevailed.
Uh-huh.
So this is something – now, I find that just a fascinating story, this sort of legal war going on between John Carbonaro and David Singer.
Sure.
Over control over the characters. And so that's something that we put in even though – these are not award-winning books and they're not – relatively, they're not selling as well as some of the DC or Marvel bestsellers, but they did have some high-profile creators. So, I don't know. I'm hoping I'm making sense. And
no, it completely makes. Especially since I remember the Thunder Agents because of what you're talking about. Like that's how I discovered the Thunder Agents, and then I went back and ended up discovering. Well, I think I knew about Wallywood from like Mad Magazine and stuff like that, those Mad comics, but. Going back and being like, oh, he did superhero stuff too. You know what I mean? That's it. I mean, that sticks out for me. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So, with all these books, again, I wouldn't say they're put together by committee. I think that's unfair to say, but the person I lean on the most is John Wells. I mean, John Wells is a really knowledgeable, one of the most knowledgeable comic book historians I know.
Uh-huh.
Also, just the nicest guy you've ever met. And so I would not only send him chapters to read, and he would, not only would he provide corrections, not only would he say, okay, you got the date wrong here, or but there are often times when I would send a chapter to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I took the liberty of rewriting this passage. And he would like completely rewrite like some section.
Wow.
And he's not being compensated. He's not being paid to do that.
Oh,
he's
wow.
just doing it for, the benefit of the project.
Oh, wow.
And, in many ways, he's a co-editor in chief, I would say, because
sure.
of as well as the author of both 1960s volumes. I mean, so like I said, he's just a tremendous resource as well as a tremendous friend.
Sure.
And, so a lot of this stuff sometimes happens just in, sort of group email discussions where we're trying to figure out, what deserves inclusion, what doesn't. And I mean, and sometimes we just run into, I remember this with the 1990s volume because if you look at that volume, that first chapter is actually relatively long.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember saying to Jason, I don't know if you realize that, we have a set number of pages. Think about with those mid-90s, like once Image took off and then you had these universes, you had, Dark Horse had its own universe and you had that Ultraverse by Malibu.
Yeah, Malibu, yeah.
Oh, and you—I mean, you just had so many of them, and it became. Yeah. I said, you know, we've got some chapters here that are going to be absolute monsters.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of the proliferation of these fictional universes.
Yeah.
And so it's after that first chapter, I remember Jason and I just sort of saying, okay, you know what? Because we still wanted to make sure that it wasn't just a DC Marvel book. I mean, there's mm-hmm. particularly in the 90s with all these, you know, with Dark Horse and Image and, you know, Malibu and, you know, these companies that really, I just blanked out. Valiant, you know, Valiant.
Oh yeah. Valiant. Know. Yeah, of sure. course. Yeah.
And I mean, they deserve inclusion. They deserve discussion. And
sure.
So at the same time, trying to mention, you know, some of these independent creators, some of these self-creators who are doing, you know, their own thing, you know, people like, you know, Jeff Smith and Dave Sim. And
oh, yeah.
So, but not just mentioning them and then just, you know, in four words and then leaving them alone. It's just like, if we're going to mention someone, mm-hmm. we got to give them some sort of, what's the phrase I'm looking for? You know,
a spotlight.
Yeah, something like, you know, some at least some type of perfunctory commentary where it's not sure. just we're not just throwing out names just in for the sake of, okay, well, you know, we're trying to mention as many people as possible.
And sure.
So it becomes, and again, fitting that all into a narrative, mm-hmm. not a Wikipedia article. It's, you know, it's. How do we mention these other publications in a sort of seamless way?
Mm-hmm.
So it's and part of my duty is to make sure that we're and so as these volumes keep getting published, I have to keep track of what has been said already, you know, and make yeah. sure that so like with Kurt, he's mentioning or almost foreshadowing things that have already been written by Bill Shelley in the 1950s volume, and I have to make sure that there's no contradictions there, that it's lined up. So
mm-hmm.
That's why I told John Morrow these books are going to be the death of me.
You know, let me ask you this, because so this may be a stupid question, but why does the 60s get two volumes where everything else gets one?
John knew he could sell two volumes on the 1960s.
Oh, really? And he didn't think sure. he could sell like the 80s or anything like that?
Well, so remember when I pitched it, you know, yeah. I pitched it as one, and he doesn't, I mean, that's a good question to ask John, is now in retrospect, now knowing, like he had major concerns about a 1990s volume.
Really?
He thought a 1990s volume was going to just not sell at all.
Wow.
Because of it's a little bit outside of his reader base. You know, his consumer okay. base are
Jack Kirby fans. Yeah.
And there you go. Like so yeah, so yeah. so the 60s into the 70s.
Sure.
Back Issue Magazine going into the 80s, but doesn't, you know, Back Issue Magazine, does it start to go into the 90s? I think it is now.
Not sure. Oh, okay.
You know, I'd have to go and look, but, yeah. but most people, you know, so it's important, like as I pitched the series, as we were conceiving of this series, he's essentially guessing at how many copies to print. And whether or not, again, these are expensive, you know, these are $50 books, and he's
sure.
trying to see if the market is willing to purchase $50 volumes.
Yeah.
And to his pleasant surprise, or to our pleasant surprise, the 90s volume sold just as well as all the other volumes.
That's great.
You know? And so I think that's why he mentioned to you a 2000 volume,
2000,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
I said,
I didn't realize I had broke that news. I'm excited that
you
I
did.
Broke news.
You did, because I even mentioned to him when I saw him at San Diego Comic-Con. I was like, yeah. So I hear that we're actually doing a 2000 volume. And he's like, well, you know, eventually. I said, yeah, John. I said,
That's great.
You know, I'm going to be in my grave and somehow still working on these volumes. You know,
sure. That's,
I don't know, you know, it's, I think I've signed on for that, you know,
that's great.
But, you know, as I've told many people, I did not nearly anticipate the amount of work involved with each volume, but
yeah, you keep saying that. It's great.
But if I had to do it all over again,
yeah,
I still would,
of
you know,
course.
Because of the reader reaction to these volumes has been so, you know, overwhelmingly great. I mean, I have, you know, people contacting me on Twitter or email or at conventions, and they're really, you can tell that they feel, you know, what they, you know, their appreciation for this series. And that's when I say, okay, you know, this makes it worth it, because if it's, you know, if it's getting this type of reaction, then we're doing something right.
And Yeah. Well, let me ask you a couple final questions, because we're coming up on an hour and you've taken time out of your evening to speak with me. And I really do appreciate it, because I am one of those fans who just loves these books. And I was like, 300th episode, I want those guys.
Hey, as soon as this podcast is over, I'm back to grading papers. So let's keep going, you know?
Well, you know, whatever. But so tell me, what were some of the most... I want to say, like, the biggest things that you learned while working on these books, like what was some of the biggest eye-opening?
Yeah, I had a blind spot for the 1950s.
Oh, really? Completely.
I mean, listen, again, the Barry Allen Flash was introduced in 1950s. So I mean, I knew about that.
Sure.
I knew about, say, EC Comics.
Sure.
But the trends of that decade, you know, a lot of the creators of that decade, I was completely clueless about. And that's why for me, Bill's book on that decade was really eye-opening for me. I mean, the things I learned from Bill, were tremendous. So that was your question, is like, what did I learn the most?
Yeah, like, what was the biggest eye-opening thing that you did not, I mean,
one of the great things about working with John Wells is that, you know, there are, say, like, conceptions. There are popular conceptions, and John will be very quick and very convincing in dispelling these common conceptions.
Okay.
For instance... you know, when Kirby went from Marvel to DC, as the story goes, you know, because one of the first books he worked on was Jimmy Olsen.
Sure.
And as the story goes, he took that assignment because he didn't want to kick somebody off of an assignment. You know,
gotcha.
He wanted to say, okay, you know, which book doesn't have a sort of regular creative team, because he would feel bad, you know, essentially taking work away from. So he was given Jimmy Olsen. Now, as John Wells details, we mentioned this in the 1970s volume, but this is a section actually written by John, even though he's not credited. I mean, these are the type of things like that I know that the reader sort of doesn't know. Like, oh, yeah, that section, yeah, that was. And I sort of dare anyone to tell me, you know, as you read through that 70s volume, who wrote what. You know, show me the passages that John Wells wrote, because I guarantee you can't, because we're, you know, we spent a lot of time sort of blending the writing styles together, you know.
That's great.
So the reality, though, was that Jimmy Olsen did have a regular creative team who did essentially get kicked off to make way for Kirby. Now, it's very possible that Kirby was not made aware of this. You know, sure. It's very possible that this is what Kirby was told. He was told that Jimmy Olsen had no creative team. Creative team, but in actuality, it did. So it's things like that, and you know, and that's why I love getting these emails from John Wells, because he'll be like, okay, you know, he's like, okay, I just finished reading the chapter, got to correct you on one thing, and then he'll go into this like 5-page, you know, explanation of what really went down, and he'll have his references, you know, he'll it's like it's not him just, you know, shooting off the cuff. It's he has done his research.
Sure.
Trying to think of another example of that, but
I might want to interview that guy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know, he's he's really busy, but let me know, because it's sure. I've been on podcasts with him before, and he's fun. He's fun to talk with.
Sure.
I'm trying to think of another example. But there are things like that where John will inform me of, here's one. You know, like the whole thing about the death of Robin, right?
Sure.
With the phone number.
Yeah.
So, you know, the common conception is that, and I'm blanking out on that. So Dick Grayson was the first Robin.
Jason Todd.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, the story
I think I
goes,
voted to kill him back then, okay. But anyway, go ahead.
So the story goes, everyone hated Jason Todd.
Sure.
Right? Everybody hated, the fans hated him. They couldn't wait to get rid of him. Blah, blah, blah. But here's the reality. So they DC did this 1-900 number where you can vote to kill off Robin.
Yes.
So finally giving the fans what they want.
Yes.
But by DC's own admission, The vote was so close, and when the phone line was about to be shut down, the vote was actually for Robin to live, and it was only this sort of last second surge of, you know, votes to kill him off that put the, you know, that made the final tally one of, you know, kill him instead of keep him.
Sure.
But in the aftermath, it was as if, you know, it was this landslide vote to kill him off. And that's just the data itself doesn't confirm that. The data shows that, well, he had just as many detractors as, you know, admirers.
Sure.
But you know, it was mostly Denny O'Neill sort of pushed this narrative of, well, the fans have spoken and we finally got rid of this, you know, this character that everyone hated. No. Yeah. That's not true, you know?
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, it's interesting as far as like that subject is concerned. I don't know how many people wanted to kill Jason Todd as much as just get rid of a Robin. You know what I'm saying? That Batman shouldn't have a Robin. Like, I remember that was my justification, was like, you know, I was young. I don't remember how old I was, but you know, it's like the mid 80s. Right. And, mid to late 80s. I can't remember.
Late 1980s.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember being like, well, Batman shouldn't have a Robin. Robin's stupid. You know, the idea of a Robin. And of course now as I'm older and as I got older, and in particular, the way they killed him off, which was crazy.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, Robin's cool. You know, like I like the idea. You know, of course, it was, you know, Tim Drake that came after that and all the things that they did that kind of like made Robin kind of cool. But it's interesting that you say that I did not know that it was just kind of like squeaking by.
It was the final tally is rather close.
Sure, you know? Sure.
So that's wow. in our that's in our 1988 chapter.
Oh, I do not remember that.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I've actually sat down and read them. But so one sort of last question.
Go ahead.
You mentioned your favorites. So it's funny because you mentioned two DC properties that I was never really fond of.
Uh-huh.
So why The Flash and why Legion of Superheroes? Because I was never into The Flash except for obviously the TV show is on now and I've watched a lot of it. And I don't know how you feel about that, but I enjoy it.
I never get to watch it because my wife is just not a fan of superhero shows. So it's sort of, you know.
Yeah, same here.
Never, yeah.
Yeah. But why the Flash? Like, what was it about
the
Flash?
Well, I think a lot of it is that I grew up, I was just a skinny, scrawny kid.
Sure.
And I loved playing sports, but what I was good at was essentially being fast. I wasn't strong.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't, I didn't have muscles, but I could run.
Yeah.
So I think I just sort of latched onto the superhero who's his power.
Sure.
So there was a sort of identification there, or at least a fantasy there
that's cool.
And that's what I really liked about the Flash, is that he wasn't strong, but he did all these neat things with speed, you know? And so, the Legion of Superheroes, was just, I think I just sort of stumbled upon it. And I think just visually, just all the, you know, the different costumes, I felt, you know, that I didn't know at the time that Dave Cockrum and Mike Grell had designed all these costumes, but I now, you know, credit them, that just looking at them, just visually looking at that whole cast of characters really intrigued me. So, and some of my all-time favorite comic books are the Legion stories produced by Paul Levitz and Keith Giffen. I mean, that to me is, really, I cherish those stories from the early 1980s. I think really,
that's great.
You know, when like the Legion are going up against Darkseid and thing, you know, stories like that.
Is that pre or post crisis sort of Legion?
That's pre-crisis. That's
gotcha, pre-crisis. Gotcha. Yeah, the Legion just always seemed like, people talk about the X-Men being dense. Like, the Legion just always seemed to me like
that's
very
always the
intimidating.
Hurdle. Yeah, I mean that's always the problem, trying to get people onto that concept is just, you know, the cast.
But to me, it's like when they show up in a comic, I think they're cool. Like, I'm like, or like on a TV show or something,
right.
I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, I like the concept of like teenage superheroes and all that stuff, but there was just so many races. And so like with the X-Men, you could be like, oh, they're all just mutants. Or the Teen Titans, it's like, okay, yeah, they're sort of like teenagers and there's like maybe 5, 6, 7 of them. But with like Legion, it was like so many alien races and so many like, you know, different characters that I was just like, how do I even begin with this?
Yeah.
But I did read some of them like throughout the years, but it's just something that never really stuck with
me. And listen, they started out as supporting characters in Superboy stories.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's, you know, it's, so what you're saying has a kernel of truth to it, is that they started out as supporting characters. So
sure. Well, Keith, I really appreciate your time. I love the books. I think
you
guys have done an amazing job. These would make amazing Christmas presents for any comic fan out there. You can get them at tomorrows.com, correct?
You can get them at Tomorrows. You can get them on Amazon.
Yep. Comic shops. You know, order them through the comic shops.
Yep. You can order them through Diamond, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
No.
You know, you don't have to, because at this point we have what? We have 8 volumes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 volumes. And, you know, don't feel obligated to buy, you know, 7 at 1. Just buy your favorite decade. What's your favorite decade? Buy that.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if that hooks you, then buy another decade. And I think that's, you know, John was hoping would be the effect, is that even though, let's say, someone was only interested in the 60s, eventually they would get the 70s volume and then go from the 70s to the 80s. And even with the 90s, I mean, there's so many people that hate 90s comic books, but but the volume has sold as well as the other volume. So either it's a completist thing where, you know, people who have gotten the other volumes, you know, want a complete set, or they just want to see what type of train wreck the 90s were.
Well, I mean, I have all of them, except I had thought I bought the 40s one, but I have not. So I've got you know, I had a big trip coming up, as you know, and that's why we got delayed as well. And, you know, Christmas is here, but like as soon as I'm going to buy that 40s volume because I have every other one. And I think this series is so worth reading, so worth checking out.
What Kurt does with that volume is tremendous. I mean, he really deserves as much credit as I can heap on him for what he was able to accomplish.
Sure, sure. Well, and I can't wait to talk to him. So, you know, Unfortunately, he was not able to join us. But, you know, the 40s is particularly that era, you know, is like kind of when things originally started exploding. So to me, That's sort of like would be a very interesting read. So I'd have to pick that up soon. But in any case, like all of them are great. All of them are extremely informative. I think teenagers would love them, particularly, you know, teenagers that are just getting into comics, you know, that like to read and and adults too. So I cannot recommend these even if highly you're, enough.
Yeah. And it is meant to, you know, not only inform people who are not, you know, that knowledgeable about comic books, but even if you are, like you said, you know, you're knowledgeable about the comics, the comic book industry. And there was stuff that you learned in these volumes that, you know, you hadn't known before.
Yeah, and stuff I forgot I learned, like the Robin thing.
Yeah,
so right. Just go back and reread it. But I appreciate your time. I love your books. You know, once again, I have been speaking with Keith Dallas. He is the ringleader behind the series of, I'll say, historical volumes, not encyclopedias, called American Comic Book Chronicles. I cannot thank you enough for your time. I really appreciate it. Is there a way for people to get in touch with you in case they want to? Like, you're on Twitter, correct?
Yeah, Twitter. So that's Keith_Dallas.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way to get in touch with me.
Great. And so, and again, thank you so much for doing the books. Thank you so much for your time. And
I really appreciate your compliments and really appreciate you having me on.
No, absolutely. I've been wanting to do this since I interviewed John Morrow, and I was hoping that, you know, somehow I would be able to get to do this. So this is great for the 300th episode of Part-Time Fanboy.
Yeah,
I'm like so
that's an honor.
Super
that's an
excited.
Honor.
No, it's an honor for me. Trust me. I am honored. You should not be honored. I am honored. But we can argue about who's honored later.
Okay.
In the meantime, this is the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. My name is Christian Horn. I've been on the line with Keith Dallas. Please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that fun social media stuff. Our email is ptf@parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye. Part-Time Fanboy.